This is a fun day for you and me. This is a day that we get to process and pray and ask God, hey, what do you have in the future for us and for this great congregation? So just thanks. And let me say something to you too. I shared this last night, but I'll share it with you. Man, you need to be so proud of your search team and elders. The way they handle this process with us, Ellen and I will tell you, we've never had it done better. We've never had it done as professionally. And just know we deserve to share with them just a round of appreciation and say thank you for all the work they've done. Wow, it's just good stuff. Just really good stuff. I want to talk today about critical conversations. We heard a little bit about that. But all of us have had critical conversations. Some of them have been fun. And some of them, let's be perfectly honest, they haven't been so fun, correct? But critical conversations are a part of all of our lives. I'm going to tell you about two, and then we'll get into the teaching. The first one was when my mom decided that my dad should have that conversation with me about the bird and the bees. And I remember my dad, the look on his face, just sheer panic. But it was decided one night that my dad was going to put me to bed. I was like 13 or 14 years of age. Now, friends, let me tell you something, parents. If you haven't had the conversation with your children about the bird and the bees before then, trust me, the keepers of the playground have already done it, and probably not in the most positive way. But so I remember my dad, we went to bed that night, and my dad is just really nervous, but in a very, very concise manner, my dad begins to talk about the differences of the human anatomy, and to be honest with you, I thought I caught on rather quickly, and I came to realize that this conversation had nothing to do with the birds and the bees at all. And my dad is just concise and to the point. And I mean, my mind is just going crazy. I remember this. And so I had like five or six what I thought were really pertinent questions for a 14-year-old. And I began to ask my dad all these questions. And my dad just freezes. And finally, I hear him go, And he patted me on the leg and he said, I think that's enough for tonight. And the birds and the bees were put to sleep that night, never to be brought up again. Now I want to tell you a second conversation. This one's a little more serious. Some of you know that our oldest son, Tyler, was born with spinal bifida. Now listen, we're blessed. God has touched our son. He's a professional golfer now. How crazy is God? But when he was first born, I mean, it was staggering for us. I mean, we were kids. Just kids trying to figure this thing out. And Ellen and I, when we first got married, we wanted four kids. Ellen comes from a huge family. I come from a medium-sized family. And we wanted four children. But after Ty was born, I'm going to be honest with you. We were very cautious. We were fearful about having more kids and what that meant. And it was amazing. God put us in certain situations that we got to do so many studies and really diagnosis of what might have gone wrong. We did this huge study with Duke University. They flew in and flew us and got all of this expert advice. And we came to understand that there's nothing in our lineage that has this, in our past of the family. But you're not certain about what does cause this. Now they realize that folic acid is a huge player in that, you know, women that take that at a very much smaller chance, but we had no idea of this in that way. But all we did was, I remember one night, we finally got to the point, this was probably a year and a half later, 2 years maybe, that we finally got to the point that we said, we really want to start praying and thinking about this. So we sat down and we put the pros and cons. We wrote them down, but we had this sense in our heart that there was, that God had given us a peace that this was the right thing, was to have another child. And so that night, after a lot of prayer and processing, we came to that conclusion. It was one of those critical conversations, and I tell you that because, you know, we began then to start the process of trying to get pregnant again. Then I was so thankful that my dad had had the conversation with me, and then we knew what was going on. But, you know, just about a year and a half later, man, Seth Jordan was born. And the joy that our lives would have lacked if not for Seth. Seth is so gregarious. This is the way I define him. Seth would have a good time at a funeral. I mean, that's just Seth. And, you know, now as he married Katie, Catherine, and Catherine's like ours. I mean, the first day she walked into our house, she was our daughter. And now, they've had our granddaughter, Raylan May. You'll get to see a picture of her, I think. We can pull her up. And they'll come. You'll get to meet her. But now we just found out, you know, we're about to be grandparents again with a grandson. And so I think about that and what would have been lost if we hadn't had those critical conversations. Now I want to get to the point of the teaching today. You and I, as God's people, and please hear when I say this, you and I as God's sent people, because that's who we are. We're not just believers who sit on our faith, correct? I mean, we're not. We are God's sent believers. I mean, the greatest mandate that's ever been given to us, we find in Matthew 28, and what's the first acknowledgement of that? Is it Jesus says to you and me, go and make. So we are sent people. That's the way we function as believers. But what we've got to understand is there's something more now today. And it's because of this reason. Our culture has changed, has it not? No, wait, has our culture changed? It's changed. It's changing before our very eyes. There is a wonderful book that if you haven't read, I really want you to be able to read. It's called Good Faith, and it's by Lyons and Kinneman. And in it, they talk about some of the, I want to say, dissonance that we find between faith and culture today. Listen to this, just as some of the statistics that they give us. David Kinneman, it used to be George Barna. Barna Research was the top Christian researcher in the country. And David Kinneman bought it from George Barna. And so Kinneman and his researchers found out that this is some staggering statistics. We find out that 42% of the people in our country today believe that evangelicals are a part of the problem in our culture today. Now think about that. That's almost 50% of the people. We found out that 60% believe that if a Christian desires to share his or her faith, they are extremist in regarding their view. And so the reality of it is that you and I are placed in some precarious positions today. And this is what happens. So many times when culture begins to, I want to say, maybe be abrasive or maybe pushes back on us, we have a tendency to retreat to the church. And I want to tell you something. You and I will never be able to help grow the kingdom of God if we always retreat to the church. Because the reality of it is, you and I are called to be God's sent people. And so today, one of the real critical issues for you and me as a body of believers is this fact. How do we position ourselves to have critical conversations with people who don't know Christ? Because I promise you, it's not just going to happen in here. But we're going to have to find a way to do that. Now that brings us to the teaching, which is in Acts 17. And in Acts 17, I believe that Paul presents to you and me literally a template for what we're called to be as a church. And one of the reasons I want to share this teaching today, because if you want to know Ellen and me and our philosophy of ministry, this passage lays it out for us. And so when I teach today, I hope I'm sharing who we are, so that you can have a better understanding and better knowledge of who Roland and Ellen are and who we will be as leaders as we come to this congregation. So the first thing we find in Paul in Acts 17 is that Paul is in many different cultures. And when you begin reading Acts 17, he's in all different kinds of cities. And some of them appreciate the faith. Some of them are really turned off on the faith. In fact, where we're beginning in Acts 17, when Paul finds himself in Athens, he's just been run out of Berea because people were so offended by the faith. So Paul has all these kind of understandings of how people respond to the faith. And yet this is what we find about Paul. The first thing we find about him is that Paul, in whatever context he finds himself in, he is present and he's prevalent for the cause of the gospel. He's always present and he's always prevalent. Listen to what he says. While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was deeply troubled by all the idols he saw everywhere in the city. So he went to the synagogue to reason with the Jews and the God-fearing Gentiles. And as he spoke daily in the public square to all who happened to be there, he also had a debate, the text tells us, with the Epicurean and the Stoic philosophers when he told them about Jesus and his resurrection. Now please know what we find here. Because Paul is so burdened and so consumed with being present and prevalent, because first, Paul is burdened for literally the condition of that city. It says Paul was waiting for them. He was deeply troubled by all the idols. Now that word trouble is a unique word. And it's a unique word for this reason. It means to be burdened to an extent that you have anger and grief. It means that something disturbed him so much that it provoked him to action. And you see, that's where you and I have to come to a place of understanding that there's a deep need in our culture for the healing power of Christ. And we will all sit and nod and say, Roland, I agree with you totally, but this is what I want to know. Will it provoke you enough to act? To get outside of these walls? And to begin to build relationships? And I'm telling you, we are around people every day for this reason. The folks that we work with. The folks that we live by. The folks that are in our family. And Paul says he's deeply burdened by this. So Paul begins to do this. Now I'm going to talk about this a little bit more. Because I promise you, this has to be the abiding factor in the life of the church. Is that we will be moved enough by the things that move God enough that we will act on behalf of God in our context. That we will be present, but we will be prevalent there. That we will speak when we have the opportunity, and we will speak up. The second part is, Paul understood something that I think is critical for you and me. Paul understood that you and I will never enter the conversation if we are not positioned to be in the conversation. Now wait, let me say it again. You see, you and I will not enter a conversation if we are not present and positioned to be in the conversation. Now notice what he says, because we find Paul in three prevalent places. First, he finds himself in the synagogue, and he says in the God-fearing Jews. And then notice the phrase that Luke uses and describes, and he reasoned with them. You see, there was a platform from which Paul could speak to these people. There was an understanding of the faith among these folks. So Paul had a platform to simply go and reason with them. Now I want to tell you that's not always the case, because you and I deal with so many people that simply do not have a background of faith. Do you know that? I mean, they are literally, I remember when we were working at Northeast Community Church, and that's where Joel and Rachel, and we got to know them. And we started discipling there. And so we asked somebody in the thing, where do you think we should begin? They said, begin at square one. Well, what we found out was that two of the people in our first group had been atheists the year before. They had no platform from which to start. So, but here Paul finds himself. And then what does it say? And then Paul spoke daily in the public square to all who happened to be there. Now this, friends, would be like the break room or the cafeteria at work. You have all sorts of people there. And what you're doing is probably talking about all different topics. But Paul understood something. Paul had to build some relationships in order to open the door for him to have the opportunity. And what does it say? To talk about Jesus and the resurrection. So Paul placed himself in two positions. And then we hear that he's moved up to another level. It says that Paul has also, he's gone to have a debate with some of the philosophers. And they took him to a place, the Areopagus, which was literally the leading council. They were the places where the moral and faith decisions were made for a community. And this started 300 to 400 years before Jesus arrived on the scene with some people that you will probably recognize, Plato and Socrates. And so this was the place where they met and where they debated even years before about the meaning of life. And so here we find Paul prevalent and understanding. But why do we find him there? It is because Paul had a deep belief that the brokenness of the community in Athens could be changed by the power of Jesus Christ. And you see, that's that underlying theme that we're talking about. That you and I have to have a belief that God's redemptive work on the cross through His Son is what our culture needs and every individual needs to find life everlasting. Now, you know, a year ago about this time, I got to go to a conference. And it was the leadership conference that Willow Creek puts on. And Kerry Robinson at Eastside was gracious enough. He called me and he said, Roland, I want you to know something. You're going to go on staff with Eastside on Friday, and you're going to end your tenure with us on Sunday so that on Saturday you can go to the conference and we'll pay for it. And that would be Kerry, who is just a dear friend. I love him to death. But one of the guys that spoke that day, his name was Ullen Mullaly. And he was now the president of Ford, the CEO of Ford. And before that, he worked for Boeing. He was an executive VP there and led them in tremendous growth. And they hired the right man, because when he came to Ford, he revolutionized Ford, trust me. But he told us the story of his beginning of his tenure there. And in the beginning of this tenure, he said they flew him to Detroit. And he said it was so unusual to me because they picked me up in a Land Rover. And he said, that was just strange to me that we're going to the national headquarters, the international headquarters of Ford, and they pick me up in a Range Rover. And they drive us back through Detroit. They take him to the Ford International headquarters. And there, the executive suite, you have to go down into a tunnel to go to a private passage that takes you up to the executive leadership quarters. And Alan said, it's just mind-boggling. But he said, the most peculiar thing happened. When you pop up, they take you out there in the executive parking lot, and he looked around, and there was not one Ford found in the parking lot. And he said he knew what the problem was with Ford. They didn't believe in their product enough to even own one. You see, here's the question, church. Will we believe in the redemptive power of Jesus enough that it will cause us to move outside this place and begin to build relationships, begin to be prevalent and present in our context wherever the Lord has placed us for the cause of being able to talk about Jesus and the life-giving power that He has through the cross? I promise you, if not, we will sit here and we will pray about it, but we will never do it. And I promise you this, God has congregations lined up for that purpose already. And what God needs is that we will be a church that is on mission for Christ, and that we will commit ourselves to that, and commit ourselves enough that we can learn how to do that. The second thing we find about Paul, am I doing okay? Are you hanging with me? Okay. The second thing we find about Paul is that he has spiritual awareness and he has cultivated a spiritual acumen. Now notice what it says. And when Paul told them about Jesus, now notice the first thing. Men of Athens, I have noticed that you are very religious in every way. For as I was walking along, I saw your many shrines and one of your altars had this inscription on it, to an unknown God. And this God, he says, whom you worship even without knowing, is the one I'm telling you about. You see, Paul understood how to speak knowledgeably to people because he was aware of where they were in their spiritual journey. He said, I know you're religious. And you know what, friends? This is what we find in today's culture a lot. A lot of people have religion. They just don't have a living faith. And that's totally different. And I talk to people about that all the time because I want them to understand there's a difference between religion and a life-giving relationship with Jesus Christ. And so when we're talking about that, it's about a personal decision. And Paul was always aware of the circumstances and the conditions of folks around him. And he did that for this reason, because he wanted to know how to talk to them. And friends, that's so important for us, because sometimes you and I have a canned approach to the gospel. I'm not negating that, but I want you to hear me. Sometimes we're rude in the way we present the gospel, because we think everybody's ready to hear it, and they're not. You see, you and I have to earn the right, and God's Holy Spirit has to give us a notion of the right timing to do this. I mean, let's ask these questions. Are these people searching people? Are they people who have no background? Are they angry people? Are they people who feel like the church has wronged them? Are they people who we don't know well enough to really have the right to challenge some of their beliefs and their thoughts? You see, what you and I've got to understand is it's so important for us to really spend enough time with people that we hear their stories so that we know how to talk to them about faith. I tell people, I was fortunate enough that I taught in the MBA program at AU, and I would always tell people this. I promise you as a leader, if you don't know everybody's story on your team, you're cheating yourself and you're cheating them. Because the reality of it is, you don't know how to connect to them if you don't know their story. That's why I fall more in love with Ellen now after 34 years than I knew her before. Because I know Ellen better. I know better how to love her. It's the same way in building relationships with friends. You know, Carl and I have been friends forever. I mean, since our freshman year at AU, Carl Addison has been one of my best friends. Now, Carl and I can talk about things that I don't talk about with other folks. Why? Because I know him that well. It's the same way when you and I are trying to build relationships with people that we want to have critical conversations with. We have to know them, and we have to become aware of who they are and where they are in their faith journey and how to bless them. Second thing is, Paul had a tremendous spiritual acumen about the faith. I mean, he could speak so knowledgeably. Listen to what he does in Acts 17 from verses 28 through 24. Five small verses, Paul defines Jesus in four critical ways. He first says, I want you to know this God, I'm talking about this Jesus, he's the creator of life. He said, this God whom you worship without knowing is the one I'm telling you about. He is the God who made the world and everything in it. Since He is the Lord of heaven and earth, He doesn't live in man-made temples. And from one man, He created all the nations through the whole earth. He decided beforehand when they should rise and when they should fall. And He'd even determined their boundaries. Now notice what He's saying. This God that I'm telling you about, He's so much bigger than the shrines you have here. He won't fit in the physical restraints that you place Him in. And He uses two words to define Him. He says that He is the Lord of all. He is the creator of all. It means He's the sustainer, the notion of all. And He even says to them, to kind of throw it in there, He said, I want you to know, what you don't understand is this God I serve has already set the boundaries for your life and what you'll do. Because that's how great He is. And then He moves on and He says He's not only the creator of life. This Jesus I'm telling you about, He's the giver of life. He said, and human hands can't serve His needs, for He has no needs. He said, He Himself gives life and breath to everything. And the reason Paul says this is because Paul knows that for these philosophers, one of the greatest desires they have is they're trying to define happiness and contentment and pleasure and purpose. And Paul is saying to them in two concise verses, Jesus is the manner of all those things. And then He says to them, and He is even the meaning of life. He's not just the creator. He's just not the giver. This Jesus I'm telling you about, He is the meaning of life. He said His purpose was for the nations to seek after God and perhaps feel their way towards Him. Now notice what He's saying. Because Paul is saying to them, you don't know this, but you're processing in your world. You're trying to get there. It's literally a verb that's used to mean crawling and pulling towards something. And Paul says, you don't even understand. And notice what he says. Though He is not far from any of us, he says, you don't even know how close you are to being able to take this step, to being able to answer, to be able to respond. And what he's saying is, for in Him we live. Notice his phrase. For in Jesus we live and we move and we have our being. Now I want to tell you why that phrase is so important. Because Paul is going back, because this is a direct quote from a poet. And Paul knew that every one of these people he was talking to would know this poet. So what Paul is doing is taking a current part of their culture, placing it right in their laps and saying, I want to tell you something. Even your poet knew how to talk about Jesus. You see, he had an acumen. He had an ability to speak to people in a way that the faith was real to them and relevant. He knew where they were and he knew how they were searching. He understood what their questions were and how to give them answers and how to approach them with it. And I want to tell you something. This is the crazy thing. Jesus Christ, by the power of His Holy Spirit, can do the same thing through you and me today. And so many people I know are intimidated to talk about their faith. But I want to tell you something. I want to share something. There's some verses, if you will, from Colossians that I think speak to us. Because the reality of it is, you and I have to be willing to grow in our faith to a place that we can have a conversant knowledge about how to talk about Jesus. You know, I shared with the team the other day, I made a commitment to the Lord probably when I was about 30 or 32 years old. Because Linda will know, Charles Lake was a gentleman who she worked for, pastored a great church down in Greenwood. And Charles Lake challenged me, asked me if he could disciple me. And my life changed. Because I thought I understood my faith, but I really didn't know the whys and the whats of it. And Charles began to pour into me and help me understand better what my faith was. And it was in that moment that I made a commitment to the Lord. I said, Lord, I promise you this. I'm going to work hard enough in my faith that I can talk to anybody as freely about Jesus as I do about baseball and other sports. Because I'm a sports nut. Man, I'm on Bleacher Report. I love it. I'm texting and watching. My boys text me every day about something. But here's the deal. That's when I began to see God open doors for me to have more conversations with people about Christ. Because I was willing to put in the time to do that. If you read in Galatians 2, you find that Paul there spent years preparing for his ministry before he started his ministry. Notice what Colossians 2 says. You received Jesus Christ, the Master, now live Him. You're deeply rooted in Him. You're well constructed upon Him. You know your way around the faith. Now do what you've been taught. School's out. Quit studying the subject and start living it. I love that. Colossians 4 says, live wisely among those who are not believers and make the most of every opportunity. Let your conversation be gracious. Let it be attractive so that you will have the right response for everyone. You see, my friends, discipleship is critical in the life of every believer. And I want to promise you something. If this church sees fit and Ellen and I see fit, that we join together here, discipleship will be a critical part of what we do in this church. And we will help grow each other, strengthen each other, give each other a knowledge of the whys and whats of our faith in such a way that we can talk to people without reservation, without hypocrisy, but just with genuine love and grace, we will talk to them about Christ and the power to change their lives. Now I'm going to finish up because I know you're getting weary. The final thing I want to say is this. Paul knew how to be thick-skinned and tender-hearted. And every believer has to learn how to be this. Now notice what it says. When they heard Paul speak about the resurrection of the dead in Jesus, they laughed at him in contempt. But others said, we want to hear more about this later. And then Paul, that ended Paul's discussion with them. But notice what it said. But some joined him and even became believers. Now I'm going to be honest with you. Some of us would have quit right after the first response and they laughed at us in contempt. And if I'm going to be totally honest with you, several years ago I would have been the same way. Because I wanted more people to like me than I did to be able to be truthful about Christ. Or I wanted to be a part of the in crowd. I wanted to be accepted in that way. The thought of uneasiness or confrontation would and sometimes make me back away from some conversations. You know, the word here means to be laughed at with contempt. It means to be seen as worthless. It means to be scorned. It means to be below another's dignity. It means to be disliked or disrespected. I'm going to tell you what, friends, it's hard to not take it personal, isn't it? When somebody are treating us with contempt about our words. But here's the reality. Paul understood that critical conversations are sometimes not hosted by the weak of heart, nor the rude of heart. Critical conversations do not always depend on others agreeing with us or us always agreeing with them. Critical conversations don't always end with a pat on the back. But it has to end with a deep sense that you and I have been truthful and honest. And we've shared what we shared with the love of Christ and the grace of Christ. I mean, we've witnessed it too much, haven't we, friends, where we as Christians see other Christians react in anger, speak in anger. We reflect that. We see that. No wonder some people are repelled. No wonder some people see that. But what we must do is speak with grace and with truth. And in today's culture, because of so many varying social issues, let's be honest, there's a part of the church that says, no, we have to be people of grace and people of grace and people of grace. But I want to tell you, grace alone is just a license to live life any way you want to live it. And truth alone can be hard, brittle. Old wine in new wineskins. We can be judgmental. We can come across angry. But see, that's what happens when grace and truth are meshed. Because you speak God's truth with love and grace. Because God does give us boundaries to help protect us and to carry us and to give us life, more life than we've ever imagined. And that's what we must do. We must be, in some ways, thick-skinned. That we're not afraid of it, that we're not fearful of it. That we don't walk away from culture, but that you and I are willing to engage and get involved and place ourselves to be prevalent and positioned in a way that we can have these conversations for the sake of Christ and His kingdom. And it's just critical that we do this. It is critical that we do this. You know, I realize that sometimes it's not easy to balance that. I realize that sometimes it's fearful for us. Because we feel the tension in our culture today, do we not? We feel the dissonance even of people and being maybe those conversations that we don't know. But I promise you, if we will be present and prevalent long enough, and I shared with some people last night, I believe in the persistence of presence. If we keep showing up for the sake of Christ, people are going to know we're genuine. If we keep loving folks and caring for people and we keep listening to people, I'll tell you two stories in closing. The first one is this. When I was finishing my work at Ball State, there was a gentleman there, and I'll just call him Steve. And Steve was locked in the 60s and the 70s. He still wore the tie-dye shirts, and he had long hair. And I mean, he was absolutely still linked into those times. But boy, I could tell he was angry with the church. And so I just started trying to build a relationship with him. And I remember we had break one night. We're walking down the stairwell to go to the vending machines. And I mean, just suddenly he turned to me and he said, "You know what's wrong with you Christians? You do a lot of talking, but you never listen." Turned around and kept on walking. What do you think I did for the next 2 years with Steve? I listened. And we got to be friends by the time it was over. I never did get the opportunity to share Christ with him, but I pray I loved him in that way. I really do. You see, sometimes you and I just have to be present. And we have to be willing to listen, and we have to be willing to build relationships. And finally, I want to tell you a story of when I ate the best steak I ever had in my life. It was down in Mississippi. Good southern place, you can tell. That's where I'm born and raised. You hear a little twang. And finally, the waitress came over and said, "Ma'am, I got to ask you something." I said, "This steak is phenomenal. I want you to tell me why is it so good?" And she said, "Oh, honey." She said, "That steak there, that steak's been sucked in so much butter, I promise you, you think your teeth are going to slide out." I'll never get that. I'm going to tell you what will happen if you will soak those relationships in the love of Jesus. I promise you barriers will come down. I promise you hurts will not be as tender as they were. And I promise you this, God, by the power of His Holy Spirit, will start opening doors for you and me to begin to have conversations that will lead people to the most life-transforming decision of their lives, and that has everything to do with this man called Jesus. And if you want to know who Ellen and I are, that's who we are. Totally committed to it. Totally sold out to it. Totally believing that congregations just like this, we, Catalysts, have to get outside these walls and take Christ with us. But we have to commit ourselves to grow in our faith. Men, I want you to look at me, because men are more difficult to do this than women. I will challenge every man in this place. If you will let me work with you and disciple, if you'll just let me pour my life into you, I promise you we'll grow in Jesus together. We'll understand the who's and the what's. Not because I'm so great. It's because God loves you so much, He wants to use you. And He needs you. You're leaders in this community. You're leaders in your families. And please hear me, men and women. Because, man, I've been so impressed with the female leaders in this place. It's incredible. And I want to tell you something. God has so much more for you to do than just lead in this place. God wants you and me to work through His power in this place to help touch a community for the cause of His kingdom. And that, my friends, that's who Ellen and I are. That's what we know how to be, because this Jesus has changed our lives so much, we can never stop doing it. Never, ever, ever. God bless you, Catalyst. Thank you for just the privilege to be here today. And thank you for the privilege to perhaps be called as your pastor. Because we are so excited about the potential of the kingdom for this place. And we say, God bless you. Thank you. Go in peace today.